your problem with the bottom of the
chin. They see the door, they turn to the chain.
Okay, on the northbound access. It's right at the light.
Look, I think, Carl, what the hell did you do? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on a donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks. Here we are back again. We're going to do the second segment of might be a three-part series on the connection with the Chicago mob and the Kansas City mob, how that got started, how they've operated together, how they're important to each other, and how they use each other, some of the people involved. And we've talked about how it got started back in the Prohibition days and how Nick Civella made his first connections up in Chicago and ran Chicago and then came back. And what really is going to tell you more about this is when he came back and what happened after he came back from Chicago the last time. If you remember the last time, he had been the victim of an attempted murder. A deputy sheriff named Louis Cuccia, Jackson County deputy sheriff, got killed in the process, and Nick Civella got away, and he ran back to Chicago again for the second time. And while he's up there, where nobody's for sure, I mean, you know, they don't like write memoirs and leave them for anybody to read. And so, but it appears he might have been befriended by a Chicago mobster named Charles Cherry Nose Gioi. And he was a lieutenant in the Chicago outfit. And what is really interesting story, and I'd like to go into this maybe more in depth sometime. I'll have to get a book and read up on it. The Chicago mob during the 40s, they started this extortion program, shall we say, a plot in Hollywood. And what they did is they got control of some unions out there, and they started extorting money from the Hollywood production companies. And several of them were involved. I guess they all worked for Frank Nitti, the famous Frank Nitti at the time. And Cherry Nose was one of them. Paul the Waiter Rica, who became their mob boss, I think, after Nitti. Is that right, Bill?
It's yeah, right he was up there.
And a couple other guys were in Leavenworth. They were in Leavenworth for extorting money from these Hollywood producers. A guy named Tony Gizzo, who we talked about earlier, was pretty high up in the Kansas City mob at the time. He had connections with Gioi and other Chicago mobsters from his horse racing activities. Law enforcement found out that when Anthony Accardo, who was a high-up mob guy in Chicago at the time, he called him what, Joe Batters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He would come down.
Big Tuna.
Big Tuna. He would come down to Leavenworth to visit these guys with their lawyer, a man named Eugene Bernstein. Well, Tony Gizzo would always meet them at the train. Of course, back in those days, you didn't fly, and it was a pain in the rear to drive long distances. So they would take the train down, and Tony Gizzo would meet them at Union Station with a car and take them up to Leavenworth. And so we know that they had that close of a connection because of that. And we also know that Nick Civella went back up to Chicago during this time.
Gizzo, as we discussed previously, had a very strong tie with Chicago. And as you described, he would be the one they called on to wine and dine and liaison with them and give them whatever help they needed while they were down here. And it was a sign of that bond between the two cities. Now, with Nick, as you say, we last left him in Chicago having fled an assassination attempt, and he's cooling his heels now because he's persona non grata in Kansas City. At some point, the wheels grind slowly, but they grind. He was given the all clear to return to Kansas City. As you mentioned, these are incidents and stories that are not etched in stone anywhere. There were no real intelligence functions at that time by the federal or local people. And, of course, the mob keeps no record. So a lot of this has to be puzzled together. And as often, there are several different avenues to look at. One avenue was that local friends and associates of Nick had gone to Tony Gizzo and asked him to intercede in Civella's behalf. The other story is that while Nick was in Chicago, having previously made contacts with Cherry Nose, was now more ensconced with them up there, and that it was Tony Accardo, who we now know had a very close relationship with Gizzo, who interceded in behalf of Civella and asked him to give him a chance, take him back. And that theory is supported by the fact that when Nick came back, he didn't just come back and go back on the street. He became Tony Gizzo's chauffeur and main man. And being a chauffeur is a main avenue in the mob's career development program, if you will. That's an important post because you're speaking for the boss. When you go out there and tell somebody you're to do this, that, or not do this or that, you're speaking for the boss and your stature is growing. It would appear more likely he got a pass from the Chicago mob.
And you know, I kind of like the other story. It reeks of supposition, but and you've got some of the tidbits in your book, and that's that Cork and Nick, and they stole, one of their things that they did is they stole tires. Mm-hmm. And Tony Gizzo had a piece of a tire shop or an auto repair shop, and so they'd steal tires and fence them through him, and he would get tires real inexpensively from him. And he had kind of a soft spot in his heart for the Civella brothers. So, you know that reeks of supposition, but makes a pretty good story, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's another avenue, you know, since we don't know, that has some credibility to it, because Tony did like the Civellas.
And actually, that could have just been part of it, you know, that he could have liked them because of that relationship. He'd done business with them, and also he had these close connections with Chicago. And right. So when Chicago said, hey, you know, we like this guy, or Gizzo may have said, you know, why don't you guys help bring him back because I like him, but you need to talk to Jim Palmateri and
Ballesteri.
About Jim Ballesteri. You need to talk to him and get the heat off of him. You know, who knows how these things work, but.
Well, that's an interesting point. I was just thinking of that because in the Machiavellian world, Ballesteri still wanted Civella dead. Somehow that had to be worked out also. And, of course, we'll never know. But it makes for a complex, intriguing story.
Oh, really? And you know, think about it. This even gets more complex and intriguing, I think. Mm. And once he gets back, it's not long after he gets back that the two Charlies are killed.
That's right.
And Jim Ballesteri, he dies somewhere around this time, shortly thereafter. But the two Charlies were really ahead of Tony Gizzo in the pecking order at the time. They were in trouble, there's no doubt about it, and their credibility was damaged. But Nick Civella comes back, and the two Charlies get killed shortly thereafter, which is going to help Gizzo in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the legend has it that the orchestration of that murder, which was a sensational murder at the time, one that had something to do with the formation of the Kefauver Committee, in fact. But the legend has it that it was Nick who had the job of orchestrating the murders. He was a lot smarter and more cunning than Tony Gizzo, actually, the guy he was working for. That put him in great stead when the time came that there was an opening.
Well, you know, that murder of the two Charlies, and we've talked about that a little bit before with Terrence O'Malley when we did that thing on mobs and politicians. But, and I didn't realize this, I started reading up on the Kefauver Commission when I was getting ready to do this. And you know, if you remember that image, that picture, which probably was on the front page of a lot of newspapers of Harry Truman smiling out over the First War Democratic Club with either Benazio or Gargatta, I can never remember which, laying there in a pool of blood. Both of them were laying there in a pool of blood.
One was leaning back in the chair and the other by the door.
The other was laying down by the door. He tried to run out the door, I understand, and they popped him as he ran out. Nick popped him as he ran out.
Both men shot in the left eye.
Right. They gave him a coup de grace, too, in the end, it sounds to me like. But Harry Truman smiled out over that, and really this publicity, you know, got the politicians in Washington to say, hey, we need to take a look at this. Because think about it, here's the Missouri senator from Missouri smiling out over a mob hit. And you know, he went
in a Democratic social club.
Democratic, First War Democratic Club.
Yeah.
But be that as may, according to what I read on this, Harry Truman and he teamed up with a later who would become president, Lyndon Johnson, who was a junior senator at the time from Texas, and they tried to prevent their fellow Democrat Estes Kefauver from forming this committee and going around and interviewing these mobs. They didn't really want this to happen.
Truman, having been brought up through the Democratic establishment in Kansas City, understood it would be devastating when Kefauver came here, what it would do politically. But he was finally overruled by others who said, if you don't do this, you know, it's going to really look bad. But yeah, he was totally against the Kefauver committee.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So shortly after, Anthony Gizzo becomes the boss in Kansas City.
When with the death of the two Charlies, he's the boss, right? And of course, Nick is his right-hand man.
Yeah, Nick's position to be like Tuffy became his underboss. Nick was probably the underboss for Gizzo and went out and handled the day-to-day activities and insulated Gizzo.
Well, the setup at the time, which was historically the way it worked in Kansas City, there were always the Mustache Pete guys in the back. They didn't want to be out front. The Jim Ballesteris and the Tana Lococos, the Joe DiGiovanni had been but had retired. But they were the people you had to answer to. There was a boss out front, but it wasn't until later that position became independent of these shadowy figures. So Tony Gizzo was the boss, answering to Ballesteri and those people, and Nick was his majordomo, right-hand man.
Interesting. And so this is, 1953. This is 50. But then by 1953, Anthony Gizzo dies of natural causes.
Right.
And you've got Tana Loco and...
Of natural causes.
Natural causes,
yeah.
Right. I've got his death certificate.
Yeah.
He died in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Down there to visit his son, who was in penitentiary somewhere.
He was his jail. Son was a dead bang drug user and had been in all sorts of trouble. And Gizzo and his wife had flown down or driven down, or however they got there, following up on their son's predicament when he had a heart attack and died.
Mm. On the way to see him?
Yeah, yeah. He had been arrested in Texas in a convenience store robbery, trying to get money for drugs.
The son had, okay.
Yeah, and had been transported up to Dallas, and Tony was going down there to
pick him up.
To get him an attorney.
Probably bond him out or give him
do whatever, whatever he could.
So he should have called first call. He had a relative.
Yeah.
I mean, really, think about it. They didn't have anything like that back then, but it could have been some help to Mr. Gizzo. But so Anthony Gizzo dies, and there sits fat and happy our good friend, Nick Civella. Yeah. Perfectly positioned. It was like, you know, this guy, you talk about him being cunning. I mean, it was like it was fate, or he was cunning enough to know exactly where to be at the right time and the connections to make, because there he is.
Well, I mean, there must have been something. I mean, when you read the notes here, and Anthony Accardo, who was the Chicago mob boss, who basically placed him back in Kansas City in this position of real, you know, authority, being the driver for the known mob boss. That didn't they think that this guy's going to become he's going to move up? They don't just put a random guy there.
Well, no, that In the protocol of Cosa Nostra, these families are totally independent when it comes to
one city to the next.
When it comes to their internal affairs. Now, Accardo could well have interceded in getting Nick a pass, getting him home. Then it was up to the family as to what happened to him. As it turned out, following the protocol, when Nick was put up for this vacancy, or was there, knowing Nick's ambition was not one stand aside, he would have politicked for the opening. He was an ambitious person.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Filardo, one of the old mustache peeps, the Sicilian bred people, was in Nick's corner, as were a lot of the other mob fellows who liked Nick and felt that he was a capable guy. And it was Filardo who reached an agreement with Ballesteri that if Filardo was successful, because any boss has to be stamped by the commission in New York, or not in New York, but the National Commission, which consisted of the five families in New York, and Chicago, Detroit had representatives. Filardo had the connections back east. He had come to this country and settled in New York, and had was a black hander in New York, and many of those associates were now big, powerful people in the city. So he had the connections, and as the story goes, Filardo manipulated or simply got the authority that Nick would be approved by the National Commission. That superseded any defiance by Jim Ballesteri, and Nick was made the boss, with Joe Filardo being the guy behind the scenes.
Interesting. And of course, in 1957, we get some real evidence of that connection, don't we?
Yeah, that's right.
And at the everybody, if you're a real mob fan, you know about the 1957 Appalachian Convention. And if you don't know it, I'll run just by it just a little bit. In 1957, there's a man named Barbara.
Joseph Barbera.
Joseph Barbera, who was from Philly.
No, he was a New York guy.
New York.
Lived in the little town of Appalachia.
He had a large house and a rural property up there.
An estate, and he had a soft drink distributing company that was front.
Oh, really? And so he invited some people, some friends up there one time. You remember that story, Bill? That New York State Trooper, what was it? He was driving by
Well, what happened?
Or did the FBI rat him out and tell him to go check on these guys?
A lot of cars out of town in a small town.
Yeah. There were no FBI interest in these people at the time in the sense of a organized crime program. Crosswell was a state policeman assigned to the barracks that covered Appalachian. And he had run across Barbera in his career. And being an astute detective, he suspicioned who Barbera was. And he had done a lot of background and found out Barbera was a connected guy. So he had a feeling for the guy. And one day he and an associate are doing a fraudulent check case. They had a fraudulent check investigation at a motel. They went into the motel to do the check case, and Barbera's son pulled up in the driveway. They hid in the back office and heard Barbera making reservations for 50 or 60 rooms or whatever they had. No names. Just put it on the bill. And Crosswell said, something's up.
Something's up.
They started checking the residence, found the cars, and broke up the infamous Appalachian Convention. Over a hundred of these people from around the country, bosses, underbosses, had met to do business.
Yeah. So who's there from Kansas City but our friend Joe Filardo and his friend Nick Civella?
Right.
Now, you know, I guess the story goes that they ran out and were able to evade the highway patrolmen as they stormed in and started kicking ass and taking names, as we used to say. But they got to a train station in Binghamton.
They got in a cab.
They got in a cab. Oh, that's it. They got
and
in
about
a cab.
5 miles down the road.
and finally got caught and identified as who they were. And you know, there's a big grand jury. Nothing really came of it legally, but there was a big grand jury and made sure everybody knew who was there.
And there were actually the New York federal grand jury did indict a whole bunch of people for conspiracy and this and that, but the case finally faltered. There wasn't the evidence.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been any real evidence.
Yeah, but they did indict them, and that created some more publicity and what have you.
Well, didn't they? They also, when they broke this up and they captured, they didn't get them all.
No.
But they were able to get a large number of these people that they maybe 60. Didn't even know.
Huh?
They didn't even necessarily know who these people were specifically.
Well,
some of them, or you think they were all had already they were known.
There wasn't a lot of intelligence about Cosa Nostra.
A lot of them probably weren't known at all by local law enforcement.
I'll tell you, right here in Kansas City, I would guarantee you that there's a whole host of people that never heard of Joe Filato or Nick Civella.
Right, yeah. Or they heard of them, but they didn't want to know.
Well, I'm talking about the general public. Guys living in Raytown. The public didn't know. Law enforcement... those who probably more the local people, the homicide investigators and all who were out on these cases, like the hits on these people, they knew about the organized crime. They didn't do anything about it, but nobody did. It wasn't their agenda to do it, but there was no laws. What was it to be a mafia guy? Nothing. But they knew about the mob. But as to any great recognition of Cosa Nostra at this time, didn't exist.
Right, absolutely did not. And this started as Joe Filacci, when he gave his testimony and everything, kind of cemented it, but this started it.
As I wrote in my book, what Prohibition did for the mafia, the Appalachian meeting did for law enforcement.
Law enforcement.
It started that ball rolling the other way. There wasn't anyone who recognized this except the old Bureau of Narcotics.
Oh, really, huh?
They knew about on both sides of the ocean because they were working the influx of drugs. And don't forget, in the 40s, we had that major Kansas City narcotics syndicate broke up. And that was a main attraction here in that era. And that was broken up by the Narcotics Bureau. So they had these, they knew about Cosa Nostra, but no one else did. No one else recognized it. And so, you know, maybe people said Hoover should, but the FBI wasn't working those cases.
Really?
They didn't rob banks.
Wasn't their mandate.
They didn't steal cars, you know.
So even after the commission came out with a report and they had some people come forward and say, yes, there is an organized crime.
They should have. Sure. We should. That is, but I'll tell you what, basically nothing came out of the Keith Alva hearing, unfortunately, across the board. And that's an excellent point. Why didn't law enforcement, Hoover included, say with this amount of evidence, what we have, shouldn't we do something about
it? Right. Even local law enforcement. You know, they didn't start an intelligence unit in Kansas City until 1960 something, and Clarence Kelly was chief of police.
Right. Yeah. It's a.
Now, was that maybe in part because the mob was connected so well politically that they were able to kind of suppress
that action?
I think you're onto something there. That's true. It's all politics, and you had a guy like Crewman who, you know, really still was trying to protect. He was trying to protect more of the political party, but he knew it was linked so closely with the mob.
And it was the same with Chicago. The Democratic hierarchy, which ran Chicago, was intimately linked with the mob.
Absolutely.
In Chicago, just like in every other major city. The whatever the ruling Democratic Party and mainly it was the Democrats in the cities. Actually, it was the Democrats in rural areas, too, in the South. But the working people, I say, in the cities, and the working people, the unions and all the working class were Democrats, and they were totally, in bed with the local mob.
Yeah.
And through the unions, so many of the unions were infiltrated by the mob.
Yeah.
It just seems to go hand in glove.
Yeah, the effect of politics continued on because Lyndon Johnson in 1969 denied the use of the wiretap law when it was passed. Mm. It, they enacted the law, and he an executive order, which we're seeing
that.
A lot of, denied any use of the wiretap law. And it wasn't until he got out and Nixon came in that we were allowed to use an enacted law.
And that's one reason, like Missouri, we had an active law that they passed and had a sundown provision on it to have wiretaps. But the local, the politicians in Missouri did not want a wiretap law. They did not want that and gave it to us for a short period of time. But, you know, I'll tell you the truth on wiretaps. And I was a supervisor and we did one, a narcotics wiretap. We did one. It is a killer. You better have your ducks in a row and you better have a lot of money. And a lot of manpower to devote to just a simple, you know, two phone tap. We had two phones tapped, and we had, you had to have people there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You had to have a surveillance crew out there about 18 to 20 hours of all that time ready to move at any point in time. And then you'd have people that sit and go over those things and get them transcribed. And oh, it was a killer. And we made no charges off of that, and nobody ever did one again, and that law just died out. Mm-hmm. Because nobody in the rest of the state ever did. The Highway Patrol or St. Louis PD, nobody ever did one after that.
You couldn't use it to record general conversations for actionable evidence to follow up later?
Well, that's a simplistic way to
look at it. I mean, we kind of talked about that with the cordless phone in the episode about
it. Sure, that was a cordless
boosting.
Phone. Just kind of sit and listen to it. We talk about the story about Junior Bradley. They gave him a cordless phone when they were brand new, and then he started using it. So we just listened to it. But with a wiretap, there's this thing called minimization. So you got to have them having some dirty talk. And if they don't have that, you got to shut it off for a few minutes.
But they kind of already knew, didn't they? They're already suspicious anyway.
Well, they're always suspicious, but they always let their guard down.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when they went to their attorney's office.
But even at their houses, there's pretty good wires on Tuffy's home phone. I was really surprised. The best one was, and everybody in the movie, everybody just cracks up. The best one is him talking with Joe Augusto, and this was his home phone, I'm pretty sure, about the codes for the airplanes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and they just couldn't get those codes right. They just couldn't get together on that. And finally, Joe says, "Well, he said, you know, you just be home, and I'll call you when you're home. Just tell me you're home. I'll call you at home. We won't have to use codes." And Tuffy says, "No. You got to use the codes anyway."
Yeah.
So anyhow, we kind of digress there on the thing. Let's we're right about 30 minutes. Let's wind down here and let's sign off and we'll do another episode.
Well, we also want to thank our special guest,
correct,
Bill Owsley. If you enjoy the podcast, Gangland Wire Crime Stories, you want to get the book, Mobsters in Our Midst.
An open city. If you're a mob fan at all.
If you like a hardcover, you get those. Bill's got a few of those.
Yeah.
And if you're into the Kindle or an ebook, you can get them that way as well. While you're at it, of course, you can put a hit out on our donate button. If you give a donation of $25 or more, you get your choice of a Gangland Wire t-shirt or get a DVD. Gangland Wire Crime Stories is produced out of the Big Dumb Fun Show, Studio 4.
All right. Good night, folks.
Good night. Thank you for having me.